From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. So a story that's published in the New York Times says that within 2 or 3 years, 90% of Americans of European descent will be identifiable from their DNA. And that means that on some level, the genealogical database and DNA bank worldwide will have been able to track 90% of white Americans. With that in mind, District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert became someone to talk to. She says DNA technology is the silent witness to the truth. Many of you know that forensic DNA work by her task force led to the arrest in May of the Sacramento man believed to be the East Area rapist, and then the NorCal rape suspect Roy Charles Waller, who was arrested last month, also through DNA detective work. DA Anne-Marie Schubert is in the studio. There are many, many topics we could talk about. I do want to focus today's conversation on DNA prosecution because there's so much to it, and it seems that the field is exploding right now. So, Anne-Marie, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me here.
The outside sense of it is that this is, to some degree, a brand new field and that it is all of a sudden reaching in ways that were never possible before in prosecution. But that's not necessarily so, is it?
Well, DNA in the courtroom has been around probably since the late 80s. My first experience was in the early 90s in a courtroom. So the forensic DNA has been around for a long time, but it's evolved to the point, the science itself, obviously with genetic genealogy, as I call it, law enforcement genetic genealogy. Now we know, in my opinion, that it's going to revolutionize, it already has, the ability to solve violent crime.
Was the game-changing factor these ancestry sites, the fact that so many different companies became dedicated to gathering databanks and expanding databanks of DNA?
Well, expanding genealogy databanks. So in California, we have, the DOJ has a DNA databank, which is comprised of convicted offenders and those arrested for felony crimes. And that has revolutionized crime fighting as well, since because that in 2004, we passed the DNA databank law that expanded it greatly. So we have had tremendous success through that databank, but now we're adding another layer, which is genealogy.
Would you give some context to what changed after Prop 69 in 2004?
Sure. So in 2004, California voters overwhelmingly supported Prop 69 and passed it, which greatly expanded who we collect DNA from. Convicted offenders, felony arrestees, some misdemeanor crimes. And before 69 was passed, if my memory is correct, the convicted offender databank had solved about 1,200 crimes, which, you know, is a good number because maybe they wouldn't have been solved. But since that time, they've solved over 65,000 cases, something 60,000 plus, or they've gotten what we call hits on, or, you know, link cases together. But it's unbelievable how successful it's been. In many of those cases, you know, but for that DNA databank, we would never have solved those crimes.
That word hits is used a lot right in this kind of a conversation. What does a hit mean?
A hit means that, so let's say hypothetically somebody burglarizes a house today and leaves their DNA behind. They cut their hand on a window. Law enforcement collects that suspect or what we call unknown profile. They test it, get a DNA profile using forensic DNA. And then when somebody's convicted of a crime or arrested on a felony, their DNA is collected. The laboratory, DOJ, tests it and develops a profile. And then every week, the Department of Justice searches to see if there's any profile of an offender that matches an unknown, you know, a suspect case. And, you know, every week there's hits made. That's what we call a hit.
So
it can be a case-to-case hit or it can be an offender-to-case
hit. How conclusive is a hit to you in DNA evidence?
Well, I mean, it's all based on statistics, but, you know, no two people, unless they're identical twins, have the matching DNA. So we have technology now where the kits that are being used are so definitive that really you're not going to find anybody else that matches that. So it's used every day in a courtroom across this country, and we get convictions all the time. I mean, you know, it's very reliable science.
After the arrest of the man believed to be the East Area rapist, there was discussion about how there was a link to someone in Oregon, that there was a possible DNA trail. Can you explain what happened there? And I think the understanding of how to get to the specific match is really critical.
I don't want to get too much into specifics of that case because it's pending. What I would say is that was a different kind of DNA search that had to do with what's called YSTR. So I don't really want to comment too much because it is pending, but it wasn't that trail, as some people have said, to Oregon was not based upon a genealogy site that was used as we did for instance, the NorCal rapist.
So we have the East Area Rapist and the NorCal Rapist as these two very high-profile cases. Were they similar in how the DNA forensics was used, or is the process different case to case?
Well, it's similar in the sense of genetic genealogy, and was utilized in both cases. The difference, you know, every case is different in the sense of you don't know who's in these genealogy trees, as I would say. So as I say, the quote, tree building, which is the law enforcement piece of it, is critical to being able to identify that someone that may be the suspect or the person of interest. So what's different, I would say, is and I think I've said this publicly, is in the East Area Rapist Golden State Killer, it was enormous amount of work involved in the tree building, you know, because of many branches and things like that. In the NorCal Rapist case, again, it was the same process, but it was, as I've said, I think publicly, it was, I would say, record-setting in terms of how quickly they were able to find the person of interest.
Can you say to what degree this has sparked an expansion of trying to link cold cases or connect cases to these two particular suspects?
Well, I think there's no question across this country that, in perhaps this world, that law enforcement, prosecutors have realized the power of this new kind of technique. I mean, since the time of the Golden State Killer arrest, there's probably been at least a dozen cases across this country. Some are really, I mean, when you look at, they're almost all murders. There's one in Fort Wayne, Indiana, an 8-year-old child who was raped and murdered that was resulted in arrest. There's ones across everywhere. You can look them all up. Washington. But I absolutely, and part of it is just teaching other folks how this works, because it's not necessarily simple. And that's part of one of my missions, and I'm sure the missions of folks that understand it, is to make sure we educate our law enforcement partners, make sure that we follow good practices. You know, we're not doing this on all kinds of cases. It's not going to be, you know, a guy that breaks into a car and steals something. It's going to be on violent crime, because you've got to balance, you know, public safety with, you know, that argument of privacy. And so, you know, the Department of Justice has had what we call a familial search policy for 10 years. So they have done familial searches through the DNA databank that DOJ has, and it has, in fact, resulted in some arrests and convictions. It's a similar concept. It just is using genealogy sites instead of the convicted offender site. But we want to have best practices, and we're trying to make sure that we follow the policies that we followed with a familial search for DOJ, meaning that it's got to be, you've pretty much exhausted your leads. It's a violent crime, you know, a rape or a murder. And so I think by us developing those practices, people understand that we're not just going out there, you know, willy-nilly trying to round up people.
So there is a prioritizing mm-hmm. of when to implement this type of technology or technique and right. and when not to. Do you foresee a time when it's more standard and the process is faster?
I think as these genealogy sites grow, you know, you may get quicker results, but it's all dependent on how they grow. And one thing we do know about these genealogy sites is that it's primarily whites that put their DNA into these genealogy sites. So it's a valuable tool that is what we call an investigative lead. You know, my attitude is that we're going to use whatever lawful sources we can, whether it's the DOJ familial search policy, whether it's just your traditional law enforcement investigation. But if you have DNA, you know, we have this tool available, we're going to use it.
On the flip side, because of the use in law enforcement, for example, are you hearing about limitations or desires for sites to limit more than they had in the past or require different disclosures in who's searching?
Well, I think the privacy argument or the conversation is going on. I mean, just last week, a study came out of Baylor Medical School where they actually, since the time of the East Area Rapist arrest, they did a study of, I mean, a survey of like 1,500 people. You know, what's your opinion about using genealogy, law enforcement using genealogy? And when it came to violent crime, it's supporting over 90% of the public supports it. So, you know, again, I think it's a matter of having best practices and doing it in a meaningful, methodical way.
I'm talking with Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert, and we're discussing DNA technology and the forensics work, in particular in prosecution. But it's important to say it's not only for prosecution. DNA
Absolutely.
Evidence has been important for the Innocence Project
Yes.
and the process of exoneration as well.
No question about it. I mean, in a lot of these cases, you hear about the arrest, but you may never hear about the people that were eliminated that law enforcement sent in a sample on. The other thing that I think is important is it can also be used for missing persons in identifying the remains of individuals that have never been able to be identified.
So explain to what degree that work is going on.
Our coroner's office has cases that, you know, they worked very, very hard to try to figure out who is this person that they've, you know, recovered the remains of. And it's just another area where we are confident that through genetic genealogy, you're going to be able to find out who that person is. And to me, you know, the most important piece of all this is that we owe it to these victims, we owe it to these families. And imagine the relief a family member might have in knowing that their missing loved one has now been identified. It's a tremendous tool that I think we have the ability now to bring some answers to folks.
Your office launched a podcast this week, Justice Journal, which I believe is based on a newsletter that's been
Yes.
coming out of the office
Right.
since 2017. And this first episode does focus on DNA technology. You talk about going back to the 1990s when there was the case of serial rapist Scott Allen Wright. You
Right.
were a deputy district attorney in Solano County.
Right.
And one of the words that you use in describing it back then is that you thought it was underutilized. So what did you see back then in terms of the potential?
Well, I mean, I've said this and I mean it. I believe it's the greatest tool ever given to law enforcement to find the truth, whatever that truth is, you know, exoneration, identification. But it's also it's the marriage of law enforcement with science. And so, you know, it requires prosecutors, law enforcement to understand the technology and how it works and what it can and what it cannot do. And so that's where my first involvement was in the mid-90s. And then I started teaching cold cases. And I think it's really become much more powerful in the last 20 plus years.
When you opened the cold case unit here in Sacramento County, when you were given the green light for that, there was the case of a murdered teenager that mm-hmm. you worked on, Ollie
right.
George,
right.
and that was a solved case. I don't know if that involved DNA technology.
It was solved 100% because of DNA.
So can you describe what was happening then in 2001 with DNA technology? I think it was like DNA fingerprinting or something it was being called,
right.
and how sophisticated we've gotten now.
Well, the science has evolved in the sense of the kits that are used have gotten more and more efficient, proficient, I guess you can say. Back in 2001 or two, when that case was solved, I guess you can say, it was one of the very first cases that was solved. And she had gone missing, and I think in 76. And then we asked our laboratory to do more testing on it, and then it was uploaded to the DNA databank, and then it identified this guy, Dennis Nelson, who actually was a person of interest at the time, but there was not sufficient evidence at the time to do anything. And so he was actually in prison in Folsom. I remember when the hit came in, I went and looked up these old 3x5 cards, and I'm like, oh my God, I think he's getting out of prison soon. And in fact, he was supposed to get out within a month. And so it was, I guess you can say, serendipity that the case had been solved. And so he was then prosecuted by another prosecutor in our office, and he was ultimately convicted and sent back to prison.
Since the East Area Rapist, how much have you been contacted, reached out to, asked to assist in other cities, other states? And I think there was something going on in Nevada in particular that you were able to work on in terms of changing law or expanding law.
Yeah. So when we were, you know, as I say, on our mission to try to identify the East Area Rapist, after the press conference in 2016, when the FBI offered the reward, I was contacted by a colleague, a guy named Rock Harmon, who was a very well-known DNA DA. And he said, you ought to look at the Nevada laws. And so I did. And I realized that while they had a DNA collection law, they were not applying it retroactively, meaning that there was a lot of people in their prison system that had not had their DNA collected. So the fact that we were a state next door, I thought, you know what, we should try to see if they'll change their opinion. So a bunch of DAs got together, talked to their Nevada DAs, and in fact, the AG and the Attorney General changed their opinion, and then they started collecting DNA from other folks that were in prison, and one of which was this guy named Ewing, who ultimately was identified as committing other crimes in Colorado, very, very horrific crimes.
As a citizen, if I can ask you to step out of the DA's office for a moment, do you believe in the accessibility of putting your DNA out there, of submitting to a site? Or there was a story this week about people actually posting their DNA profile in hopes of looking for family members. Right. But what's your personal feeling about that?
My personal feeling is that, if I was going to put my DNA in it, I haven't put it in a genealogy site, but I think the world knows now that, you know, law enforcement may use it. And even the primary one, which many people talk about, which is GEDmatch, it says right there that law enforcement may use it. And my own personal feeling is if I got a distant relative or somebody in a tree of mine that committed a violent crime, then so be it. I'm not offended by that at all. I mean, that's just the nature of my own philosophy.
Ultimately, with this evidence going into court on these two very high-profile cases, mm-hmm. East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer, and the NorCal Rapist, how certain are you of the cases going in with DNA evidence being your primary tool and piece of evidence?
Well, I mean, we don't file cases unless we believe we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And we filed those cases. And we're going to proceed on, and that's what we're going to do.
Well, like I said, I wanted this conversation to focus here. I know there's a lot of anticipation about news of the investigation of the Stephon Clark case. Your office does not have that case yet, and we are not there with that news.
That's right.
So I appreciate you coming in today and focusing here, and I look forward to ongoing conversations
sure.
about this.
Well, thank you for having
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. That is Sacramento County District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert. You can find more, and we'll post a link to that article in the New York Times at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio.